Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, our first episode of 2022, WAM President Carrie Cranston sits down with Layla Saad, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Me and White Supremacy. This conversation originally took place February 5th, 2020, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. Layla will be joining us this coming February 17th for a virtual event to discuss the new edition of Me and White Supremacy that is geared toward young readers. This program is free to attend, and you can register for it online at americanwritersmuseum.org/calendar. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, Layla Saad. Her book, Me and White Supremacy, grew out of an online effort to get people to confront and disassemble the ways they benefit from whiteness and become what she calls good ancestors, people who leave a legacy of liberation for others to follow. She's a writer, a speaker, and podcast author. She earned her Bachelor of Law degree from Lancaster University in the United Kingdom. She lives in Doha, Qatar, and her husband, Sam, and two children, Maya and Mohammed. So we are very excited to be able to talk with her tonight.
Very happy to be here.
I'm going to start with this. This is a really fascinating workbook and a really, you know, great exploration of a topic that we, you know, are all interested to talk about more tonight. But in this book, you're asking white people, and particularly white people in the United States, like me, to confront the racism. You say outright that you know this can be an uncomfortable process. Can you talk about what motivated you specifically to tackle this as a writer?
Yes. So it's so interesting because I've been asked this question so many times now on this tour. And I think if I had known before embarking on this journey of doing this kind of work, if I had known what this journey was going to be ahead of time, I might not necessarily have chosen it. You know, the work that I was doing before, I was a life coach and a business coach, wasn't doing anything controversial or, you know, anything that would make people uncomfortable. If anything, I was like, come, I will take care of you and help you grow your business. But in 2017, when the Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally happened in Charlottesville, it was a turning moment for me because I remember seeing the images of the men marching in the streets, which we can all remember, the torches, the racial slurs, everything. And it was like a light just clicked over for me. And I had things that had been brewing up inside of me for many months about things I was observing in the life coaching space, the spirituality, wellness, personal growth space, that I could see was white supremacy, was that people who looked like me were the minority. People who looked like the majority of people in this room were the majority. And I wanted to know why. Why was that the case? Was it because people like me didn't do this kind of work? Or were we being excluded from being seen as the experts, the leaders, the credible people? And so I wrote a letter, an open letter called I Need to Talk to Spiritual White Women About White Supremacy. And I was addressing things that were brought up within me and asking people in that space to look at. You say you want to change the world, heal the world. You say you're all about love and light. You say you don't see color, but racism is running rampant in this space, and we need to have a conversation about it. And so I got started on that journey through this letter that went very viral, very, very viral. And so fast forward a year later, one night I'm just thinking about what have they learned in that time since we started having this public conversation. And I grabbed my phone and start writing, what have you learned about you and white supremacy? And I thought, well, what is white supremacy? And what had I observed of it? What had I experienced of it? And started listing out dozens of these things: white silence, tone policing, cultural appropriation, white fragility, dozens of these prompts that I quickly realized wasn't a single post that I was going to share to my community, but rather was a journey. And so I created this 28-day journey, posted it on Instagram that night, said we begin tomorrow, a 28-day journey to explore your complicity in white supremacy. Sounds fun, right? Sounds fun, right? Uh-huh. And I really thought not many people are going to want to go on this journey because it doesn't sound fun. It sounds uncomfortable and hard. And I woke up the next day, and there were so many people who said, I'm scared, but I'm in. And we started that challenge, and I had 19,000 Instagram followers. And by the end of the 28 days, that number had more than doubled. We had people coming in every single day to do this work. And so it's been an incredible journey, because all it came from a place of the anger and grief from Charlottesville mm-hmm. and what I was seeing, and then the curiosity of what have they learned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So the you started this on social media. Mm-hmm. As you described.
Which is, I feel like, a very millennial way of
writing
a book.
So what made you then want to try and convert that social media experience into a book?
Is there anybody in this room who did the original Instagram challenge? No, okay. It was an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. Because it was for the first time people having very public conversations around their own unconscious racist thoughts and beliefs. And I'd never seen it done before in that way. It wasn't behind a paywall or in a private setting. Anybody could come on my page and read what was being said. And I knew from day one that this was a very special thing that was happening, and I had to pay attention. And I knew by the end it had to become a book, because There were people who were watching the challenge who were too scared to join in, mm-hmm. and I knew they wanted to do the work, but they were afraid.
Right.
And that because of the transformations that I had seen, I knew it had to go beyond a challenge, which I knew I would never run again. It's hard. Never doing that again. But it was so incredible that it had to go beyond that live experience. And so I decided to turn it into a workbook. And the great thing about doing that was I was no longer constrained to the Instagram caption size. I could write at length. Mm-hmm. And I had learned some things. I didn't realize how hard it would be for me and for the people I was asking to go on this journey. And so what I did with the book was, let me just prepare you for what you're about to experience, and let me equip you for a journey that's going to be very uncomfortable. And so we included extra things in the PDF workbook.
Yeah, and having gone through it, in those intro pages do help get you to the notion that this is not light work.
Right.
This isn't something that you can do without a real heavy amount of effort, because it's going to ask you some really hard questions.
Yeah.
Now, the exercises that come in the workbook, obviously, when you did them online, you did them in a particular order.
Yeah.
You had to think about, here's day one, here's day two, and you're asking different and more challenging questions pretty much each day.
As we go, right, it's like leveling
up. It gets a little
up.
Bit harder. somebody starts and says, I'm good, good. And then, they start seeing themselves, they start seeing their complicity, they start seeing these issues. How did you decide when you were doing it the first time?
Yeah.
What was the right order? And did that change when you put it into a print book?
Yeah.
Or did it modify? What were those decision points?
So the night that I received the download of what the challenge would be, I actually received dozens. I wrote dozens of these things down. And then when we started day one, which was just the next day, when I woke up and thought, oh no, I've said I'm going to do this thing and now I actually have to do it, and from day one, when I was like, let me just choose the easiest one, which is white privilege, because I know some people have heard of this term, so it's a good starting point. As I began to see the way people were engaged just on that day one post, I was like, oh no, you have to make it make sense. The thing that comes next has to build on what just happened.
Right.
Because, at first, it was, like I said, it was the night before and then the next day. And so my plan had been to just share them in the order that I had received them in. Mm-hmm. But it didn't make sense to do that if it was going to be a sequential journey.
Right.
And so I was very intentional each day about what was going to come next. And that same order and those same prompts have remained the same from the challenge to the PDF workbook to the hardcover book. It's the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you were definitely composing that order as it was happening in the
challenge. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the responses that you were getting were.
Yeah. And one of the main things that was important to me was not to do, so week two, the day 8 to 15, mm-hmm. that's a hard week. That's the week we look at racist stereotypes, anti-blackness, cultural appropriation, the things that most people, most well-meaning people who do not want to be associated with racism, don't want to admit to. Mm-hmm. So if I had started that in week one, most people would have shut down. Mm-hmm. Because consciously, the way that many people see themselves is, I'm not racist. Because I know what who racists are, and they're the bad people. They're the ones who marched in Charlottesville. I'm not one of those people. Right. So I can't even hear this. And so in week one, we start with what I call the basics. And what those do is allow you to understand that white supremacy is not a fringe thing that only some people do. It's actually this whole system and this whole belief and this consciousness that all of us have been conditioned by in different ways. And so when you get to week two, you're more open to the idea that maybe I do have anti-black thoughts, maybe, since I had all these other things that seem to resonate with things that I know I've done and said and thought.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then on that same line, you were talking about how the people were speaking, and that was helping you guide which challenge you were putting to them next and how yes. you started to order things.
Yeah.
The other thing you mention in the book is obviously the difference between the book and the challenge was yeah. that it wasn't just your voice out there.
Yeah.
As you were posting these things, people were responding online. And then some people who might have been working through the issues as a white person trying to adjust or confront yeah. or deal with this, there were other people chiming in. Women yes. of color, other yes. voices that were adding to the conversation. How did that influence you then when you went to create the workbook?
Yeah. So the biggest surprise to me was that out of nowhere, black women I knew and didn't know showed mm-hmm. up to help facilitate the work voluntarily. And they didn't have to do that. And my instinct was to try and protect them. Don't look at this. You don't want to read this. It's not nice. Don't look. But they showed up and they helped me facilitate the work. And they collectively have been so integral to me. I have two of my closest friends here who are sitting up front who are black women. And they, you know, it's that sisterhood and that working together that is so integral. When I went from the challenge to the workbook, now I was alone and it was just me. But the support that they gave in the challenge helped me to push more as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, because there were some voices in there that were like, no, cut the BS. Like, let's, yeah. you know, go deeper. And it helped a lot.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So this is, to some extent, you know, a book that has definitely your writing, but a communal support behind it that yes. had an influence on it.
Yes.
So a very different type of...
And I think that's so important because nobody does anything alone.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody does anything alone. We're sitting in the American Writers Museum and we get to see the legacy, the body of work of so many incredible writers, some of whom, you know, are just everything to me. And I stand on their shoulders because the work that they did has so informed the work that I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. A big part of the book is this notion of journaling. You're asking people to write. You're asking them to engage with these questions and write their responses. I was a writer's museum, so my question becomes, why is it more important for them to write their responses than to just have a conversation with someone around these questions or think about it? Why do you want journaling to happen?
So there, I have two answers to that question. The first one is that when I first started having conversations about race, when I wrote that open letter, it was like a street battle every day on social media, trying to convince white women, no, this is real. Mm-hmm. This, you do this. And it was exhausting. It was really exhausting. And what I found when I, instead of telling, asked, it flipped things. It made it easier on me and it made them more open to having the conversation.
Right.
And so that's one part of it. But the other part is when we just, if we're just thinking about it, if you just read the book and think about it, you keep things at a very intellectual level where it's, you're processing it here, but you're not processing it inside. And so when we're talking about racism, racism is not an intellectual study. It's people's lived lives.
Yeah.
It's their lived experiences. And so that has to be matched with a lived embodied experience of trying to understand your own unconscious thoughts and beliefs. Because they don't theoretically harm people of color, they actually harm people of color. And so it is important to use your whole body to put pen to paper, to write out and bring to the surface things that, when you just consciously think about them, are not there immediately.
Yeah, and I agree fully in the power of writing to make things happen and change. In the introduction to the book, you talk about the need to be a good ancestor. Can you tell us what that means? What does the phrase mean to you?
Yeah, so good ancestor, I think, saved my life and helped me to be able to sit here and have this conversation with you now in a way that I'm able to have it. When I talked about when I first started doing this work and how hard it was, I went from being somebody who, like I said, I was a life coach, right? I was very optimistic, very hopeful, very positive. And when I wrote that letter and began to experience the very nice women who were in my community suddenly have this reaction of what Robin DiAngelo calls white fragility, which is that many white people are not used to having nuanced and complex conversations around race. And so when the conversation is brought up, they have a very sometimes violent reaction to it. You know, it's defensiveness. It's getting angry. It's getting up and walking away. It's saying things they would have never said. They couldn't even imagine that thing would come out of their mouth, or crying. And so I went from being that hopeful, positive person to very negative, very pessimistic, very hopeless, because I couldn't see if this work has been done for the amount of time that we know it's been done, which is fighting for the liberation and the inequality for people of color. It's been going on for so long, and I could read things that had been written by writers like Audre Lorde, and read it and think she could have written this today. It's the exact same experience I've had today. Yeah. And I needed something bigger than what I was seeing to allow me to continue on the journey. Because I couldn't do it from a place of resentment and hopelessness. And so this idea of being a good ancestor went beyond me. Mm-hmm. It became about my children and my descendants. It became about the people who will come after I'm gone. And so I use that. I have it on the cover. I host a podcast called Good Ancestor Podcast because I needed it. But what's been really interesting is so many people have resonated with it for themselves. And I think for people who have white privilege in particular, what it inspires or what it activates within is this idea that I didn't create white supremacy, but I absolutely benefit from it. And the white people who came before us didn't fix it, didn't dismantle it, didn't change it. Perhaps I can do what I can do right now in this lifetime to create a different future for those who will come after I'm gone. Right. And so it's been this thing that, as I said, selfishly it was for me, but it has helped so many people.
That's great. And can you tell me or us, you know, some of the people you feel left the kind of legacy you want to leave, who you would consider good ancestors?
Yeah, so easy for me to answer. I will say, actually, before I say the people that we all know, I would actually, the first people are my parents, and they're living ancestors today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I got the news of, you know, New York Times, just as we were arriving here, you know, I called my husband first, and then I called my mom, and they're in Qatar, and it's 2 a.m., you know? But I woke them up and told them, because everything they poured into me make me who I am today. Yeah. Everything, the spirituality, the ability to write and speak, everything I get from them. So they're first. But after mom and dad are writers. You know, we were sat over there waiting, and there's an image of Octavia Butler on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I bookend the book. I open it and close it with her words. She's a huge influence for me. Audre Lorde as well, who I mentioned as well. Black feminist women who did this liberation work in different ways. You know, Octavia Butler was not an essayist. She was a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
But I spent, I think it was 2018, 2019, reading through her entire collection. And if you've read The Parable of the Talents and The Parable of the Sower, the character in that book mm-hmm. is what inspired me to want to be a good ancestor. Okay. And she documents everything, this character, and it reminds me how important words are. The power of words, because they live beyond us. They live beyond us.
That's great. You mentioned, you know, there's a month's worth of content in this book. Yeah. And really, it's more than a month's worth of content, because you discuss the idea of people being able to walk through it in that 28-day cycle, but they can easily go back to it. Yeah. But you really want them to step through it in the order in which it's kind of put the first time.
Yeah.
So we can't go over all of these concepts tonight, and we want you all to buy the book and to do it yourselves and to do the work, as you mentioned. It's really important for people to do the work if they want to engage with this content. So I just wanted to ask you about three that I think, you know, as I read through it, you know, hit me. And so I want
Did
you to...
Did you see yourself in them?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so I want to know... you know, how you define them, and, you know, how do you want someone like myself to respond to these concepts? Yeah. So the first one is white silence.
Okay. So the first, just to sort of zoom out a little bit, that the aim of this book is for people to understand that white supremacy conditions and has infiltrated all of us. And what racism isn't just what we can all point to and say that person's being racist, but is these unconscious thoughts and beliefs and behaviors which you take as normal or it's not that bad, and understand that no, those things actually perpetuate white supremacy, and or they maintain it in place by their non-action. And so white silence is one of those things. Mm-hmm. Being silent when you see something racist happening, and again, I'm not just talking about seeing somebody call someone a racial slur, but seeing somebody being mistreated, being, you know, racially aggressed in normal situations, and just thinking, is it worth it to say anything? Is it my place to say anything? Does anyone even notice if I say anything? And then just choosing to stay silent, that actively keeps it in place. It's not neutral. It's not a neutral behavior to be silent in the face of racism. And so, you know, I was saying earlier, you didn't create white supremacy. Nobody here alive created it, but you maintain it. And right. White silence is one of the ways that you maintain it.
Yeah, and as I mentioned to you, it's, you know, that thing of even just the scroll through Facebook, and you see something yeah. from someone you knew in high school, or you see something from a family member, and you ask the question, am I going to confront this here and now on social media? Right. Am I going to,
and there's,
you know,
different ways that you can yeah. talk yourself into silence, mm-hmm. talk yourself into not saying anything, and making a case for why it's, is it worth it,
right.
and moving on. Did anybody actually get harmed? And moving on. Was it that bad? Were they just having a bad day? Maybe they didn't mean it that way.
Right.
There's different ways you talk yourself into white silence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was one. You also talked about the concept of white centering.
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, white supremacy, and let's define what it means. White supremacy comes from the root seed belief that people who are white are superior mm-hmm. to people of other races, and therefore deserve to dominate over those people. And that has looked, you know, if we just look back on history, we've seen that looks like colonization, genocide, land theft, enslavement, different ways that this has shown up in very violent ways. And people can say, well, that happened before, but it doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
White centering is very subtle. When I talked at the beginning about why was it that in the space that I was in, life coaching, that industry, there were so few people who looked like me, white centering played a huge part in that. And this is this idea that if I'm remembering a conversation I had once. I've been podcasting for a while, and I make an intentional effort to mainly interview people of color, especially black women. And a question that I got once from a white woman was, is this podcast for me to listen to? Because it was mainly mm-hmm. people of color being interviewed. And I said, that's so interesting. Does that mean I have to ask, when I see the majority of podcasts which have majority white guests, do I have to ask, is this podcast for me? White centering is this idea that if something is presented by white people through white people, it applies universally.
Yeah.
But if it's through people of color, it's only for those people, right? And another example I was giving recently in a book event was, I, you know, when you watch movies, I watch sort of through two lenses. I'm watching the story, but I'm also watching what's going on racially. And I'm not just looking for, do they have a certain number of people of color, a body count, but how close are those people of color to the role of the protagonist? And I said, something I've noticed that's really interesting is, if in a story, and it doesn't matter if it's a romantic story or not, but there's a romance line, if in a story, one of the romantic partners is a person of color, the other person will not be a person of color unless it's seen as a black movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Unless it's seen as a black movie and then the audience is black people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if what happens most of the time is that both romantic partners are white, and that's supposed to be a universal story of love that we can all relate to.
Right.
Right. She said it, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what white centering can look like in very subtle ways, mm-hmm. that doesn't allow people of color to be the center of the story. They're always a side character. Our stories are always marginalized.
Right. And then the other one that I thought was, you know, rather powerful was the, you know, your conversation about white saviorism.
Yeah, what's really interesting about that is I was on a plane recently, and the man sitting next to me, we were cheering because nobody had come to sit in the middle.
Yeah.
So we're like, yes!
Best thing ever.
Three seats, two people. Okay, awesome. And so I was like, so what do you do? And he's like, well, I... He said, we were flying to here. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, this is my short flight. I'm actually going on a longer flight to Africa after this. And I was like, in my mind, I'm like, Africa is a continent, not a country. Where in Africa are you going to? And he said, Kenya. And I was like, oh, cool. My dad is Kenyan. Where are you going in Kenya? And he's like, Nairobi. And I said, well, what are you going to do there? And he said, well, I'm the COO of this food program, nonprofit, and we provide meals. And we do it in the US, and we have five programs here, but we have one in Nairobi.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, my spidey senses are out because I want to know what's going on. And I'm asking and investigating and asking all of these questions. And it was the basis of the company. It was also very much faith-based. So it was sort of like a Christian program,
yeah,
which is fine. I mean, there's Christians in Kenya, you know. Yeah. But I was like, I'm not going to go deeper into this conversation because I don't want to, you know, we just met. and what was funny after that, he asked me, what do you do? And I was like, well, let me show you my book. That's what I do. And he took a picture of it and everything. But it's this idea, you know, this story is this idea that white people can save black and brown people from our inherent state of wretchedness, I guess, and
yeah.
and lower worth. And that can look like missionary, you know, projects to black and brown countries, but it can also look like trying to speak for a black woman when she can speak for herself.
Right.
You know, it can be very, very subtle. And so If we root it back to where this comes from, it's that same belief that white people are superior to people of other colors. And so what white saviorism does is it's this belief that I know better for them what's best for them.
Right.
Because I'm white, and colonization and the whole idea behind that was to go and save black and brown people. I was at there's a museum in Arizona called the Heard Museum, and it's for the advancement of American Indian arts. And there was an exhibition upstairs about the boarding schools that Native children were forcibly put in and stripped of their entire identity and put in these schools. And throughout the exhibition were words that were used at the time of this policy.
Right.
And it was, you know, take the Indian out of the man, make him into a man by taking away his his culture.
Right.
Because we know what's better for them than they do.
Yeah. And those are all, you know, as you go through the book and as you go through these different things, each of these has a different hit and a different amount of weight for individuals. Now, I picked three.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you think people need to know about, another part that I didn't touch on?
I think a big one that many people who start the work, a big one that often feels like a slap in the face when they get to it, is white exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And I think that's around day six. And what white exceptionalism is this idea that I've read all the books, done all the programs, watched all the documentaries, reposted all the articles and posts on social media.
Right.
I'm one of the good ones.
Yeah.
I already know this. So I don't really need to go that deeply, because let's be real, if I wasn't one of the good ones, I wouldn't have picked up this book in the first place.
Right.
And so it's this conversation, this sort of self-congratulatory conversation of, I'm already, I don't need to go that deep. And white exceptionalism, that day comes up, and it's a call out. It's a call out that it's you too.
Yeah.
It is you too. And be careful of getting into a space of thinking you're one of the good ones, because that leads to a sense of, what it leads to is you become more harmful to people of color. When somebody is outright with their racism, I just know to stay away from them.
Right.
I just know to stay away from them. But if somebody is like, I'm one of the good ones, you can be safe with me, and they haven't examined what's actually going on underneath the surface, and they cause harm in a way they didn't even realize caused harm, that's actually more painful to experience.
Right.
It's more painful because you weren't expecting it. Because they created the sense that they're safe to be around. And then you went and told them something that you experienced that was racist, and they say something back to you like, you know what, though, I've experienced that as well. And so maybe it isn't racism, maybe it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize they didn't see you, they don't understand.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're not listening. So now, your heritage, personally, East African, Arab, British, Black, Muslim, and you live in the Middle East now.
Yeah.
So what kind of perspective do these identities and experience bring to your writing?
Yeah, it's so interesting. This process of doing this work externally has helped me so much in owning all of who I am. I grew up in Wales. I was born in Wales, and I had a Welsh accent in the beginning of my life. thankfully, it's gone now. But I grew up as a Black Muslim girl in a predominantly white space, going to predominantly Roman Catholic schools. So I was always aware from the very beginning. My mom has a recording of me when I was about 3 years old. And so I was listening to it recently, and I'm in the background singing, "Welcome, baby Jesus, welcome." And I said to my mom, "What was this?" And she said, "You used to sing it all the time. It was this nursery rhyme. It was this nursery rhyme that you had in nursery, and you used to sing it all the time." And so I've always been aware of my difference, because I would go to school, and we would pray how we pray at school, "Our Father who art in heaven," right? And then I would come home, and we pray in an entirely different way.
Right.
And so it was hard, because I had no other person to share that experience with. And the story that I made up in my mind about all of that was, I don't fit in, and who I am isn't acceptable. And who I am is something I should be ashamed of.
Right.
Because it isn't the mainstream. And so doing this work, helping others to do this work, has meant I have to do my work. And owning all of who I am, and learning to love all of who I am. And so what I think I bring to this conversation is I'm able to toggle between two big perspectives, a Western consciousness and a non-Western consciousness. I can zoom in. I grew up. I understand how you think. And I can zoom out and say, but that isn't the whole picture.
Right.
And so I think why that's important is, although we're here in the United States at the American Writers Museum having this conversation, it's important to remember that white supremacy isn't just an American thing. It is a global phenomenon. White supremacy has touched so much of the world through different ways. It shows up differently in different countries and different spaces and places, mm-hmm. but it's all white supremacy. Yeah. And I think having those different perspectives of growing up, you know, being born and growing up in the UK, I lived in Tanzania for a portion of my life, and that's where my mom is from, my father's from Kenya. Those are countries that were touched by the colonization of, you know, Great Britain. It's the reason they moved to the UK was because they spoke English, because they were colonized by the British, right? And living in the Middle East and seeing, no, even when white people come here, they're treated as superior to people of other races. And so what I'm trying to do with this work is not take a political stance, not take a country-specific stance, but actually help people to understand this is a thing that many of us are conditioned into, and it's about changing from the inside out, raising that consciousness and changing from the inside out.
Okay. And then the last question I'll ask you is, you know, who are some writers who were important to you in the process of forming your thoughts on this and in putting this together? You know, who are writers who've influenced you?
Yeah, so it'll be the same as the ancestors, right? So Octavia Butler, Audre Lorde. I was at the Chicago Public Library yesterday, and when I was in the green room there, there were images of other writers who've influenced me. Alice Walker, bell hooks. Yeah. I also want to shout out my friend Lisa Renee Hall here, because she does anti-racism and unconscious bias work, and she also uses a process of reflective journaling to help people get into the core. And so there are amazing, brilliant people who have passed, transitioned, and people who exist today as living ancestors who are just doing incredible work, and all of it imprints on you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you mentioned bell hooks, you mentioned Octavia Butler, and the differences there obviously are, you know, the essayist and the scholar versus, say, the science fiction writer.
Right.
Which do you think has more impact on making people think?
I mean, I can't talk for people, but I can talk for me.
Yeah.
And for me, I need all of it.
Yeah.
I need the Toni Morrison and the Octavia Butler, and I need the Audre Lorde and the bell hooks. I need it all. I need the poets, the Lucille Cliftons and the Nikki Giovannis. I need them all because I'm a human being who processes things in many different kinds of ways. And I need knowledge, but I also need heart. And fiction and nonfiction and poetry impacts us in different ways where it builds up this, it builds this very nuanced and very textured way of understanding what white supremacy is, which is not, it's not just, no pun intended, black and white. It's not just racist or not racist. Yeah. It's how does racism and white supremacy impact us in different ways, from the feeling to the thinking to the feeling, everything, you know? Yeah. So I need all of it.
That's great. So I want to thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd like to ask you all to thank Layla for coming out tonight.
Thank you.
I hope you all had a wonderful time. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. We'll be back next week with Angela Terry, author of Charming Falls Apart. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.